It's been a whirlwind, but a good one. I want to say just a few words tonight by way of thanksgiving for the invitation to be with you, for the opportunity to join my son in this work. Thank the elders for the invitation and for allowing me to insert my son, because it's a first for us. I hope you enjoyed his part as much as I did. I'm a little prejudiced, but I think you did a good job. And I hope he'll do more of that. That's certainly my hope and prayer. And I want to thank you for your encouraging remarks, for all you young people who've come to be here, for the weekend that you had together, and for the provision that has been made for you. It's been a great weekend, it seems to me. I hope this church will continue this for a long time to come. It's a good thing. And I want to echo what Benjamin said this morning about Wilson and Carolyn. You all have been special to us and our family for a long, long time. And thank you for taking us in. And Marilyn sends her special love and appreciation for taking care of both her husband and her son this weekend. And you've done a wonderful job, as always. Sure enjoyed the eating time together today. You folks do know how to cook around here and provide. And there was plenty, wasn't there? Even for all those people. So it's been a great weekend. This last lesson is designed to have us look at the universe. We've been looking at the microscopic world. In this lesson, I want us to look at the macroscopic world. I'm not an expert on any of this. I'm better expert on microscopic than macroscopic, so just understand that. I'm going to share with you things that I have learned from others, but I do believe the evidence is powerful and that it grows in this area just as it has in the other. So thank you, and let's get at it. Is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age? That's been our theme, and we've based it on Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, where I will start again this evening. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, or divinity, if you like, so that they are without excuse. The Bible itself teaches that we can learn about the existence of God independent of the Bible. And it's the famous argument from design. So once again tonight, I want you to look with me at evidences from the natural world that point to design, which then in turn points to the grand designer. So I start with this very famous picture. The name of this picture has come to be Earthrise. And I'll just tell you a little side story here. I don't have time to explain it all to you, but I have in my possession the original print of that picture. If you want to know more about that, ask me later. I do have the original print of that picture. Probably the most famous picture that's ever been made. So I want to start by reading to you a little bit about that picture. On Christmas Eve, 1968, many of you weren't alive. I was. Apollo 8 astronauts, Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders became the first human beings to see the far side of the moon. The moment was as historic as it was perilous. They had been wrested from Earth's gravity and hurled into space by the massive, barely tested Saturn V rocket. Some of you remember this? Nod your head and make me feel better. Although one of their primary tasks was to take pictures of the moon in search of future landing sites, the first lunar landing would take place just 7 months later. Many associate their mission with a different photograph commonly known as Earthrise. Surely you recognize this is the surface of the moon around which those astronauts were flying. And this is what they saw as they came around the backside of the moon and for the first time in history saw an Earth rise. Emerging from the moon's far side, the astronauts were suddenly transfixed by a vision of the Earth, a delicate, gleaming swirl of blue and white, contrasting with the monochromatic, barren lunar horizon. Earth had never appeared so small to human eyes, yet was never more the center of attention. To mark the event's significance and its occurrence on Christmas Eve, the crew had decided, after much deliberation, to read the following. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The reading and the reverent silence that followed went out over a live telecast to an estimated 1 billion viewers, the largest single audience in television history. You think that would be allowed today? A lot has changed since 1968. Frank Borman and James Lovell became stronger believers in God after this experience. They just felt like what they were looking at surely was made by God. William Anders, on the other hand, became a stronger atheist. He experienced the same evidence, but his reaction was the complete opposite. He looked at this and saw, look at that blue spot out there in the midst of all this nothingness. I don't see any evidence of God out here. You seriously think God's interested in that? So I'm here to tell you that the same evidence can lead you in different places. We heard that in the sermon this morning, didn't we? Even the Lord Jesus Christ speaking to people can bring completely opposite reactions to the same thing. Well, such is true also of the evidence of the natural world. There's a whole lot that goes into that, but there's some things that drive people away from God. I hope your minds are open enough, and by the way, if somebody's listening to this or is even here this evening who's an atheist or has an agnostic view of life, I just want to thank you for being willing to at least come and listen. And I hope you will open your minds and heart to the idea that there may be a designer behind all of this. So what do you think about that? Can you picture yourself in the spaceship looking at that for the first time? Well, here's another one. It was in the late 1980s that this spacecraft took off from Earth. Voyager number one spacecraft started on Earth and followed this pathway out beyond our solar system and leaving. And the idea of Voyager 1 was send it out as far as it'll go, just let it keep going and take pictures and send them back to Earth. In early 1990, the Voyager 1 spacecraft sent a picture back that's become very famous. And I want to show it to you. You ready to get my lights off? Because you can't see this very well with lights on. And with the light coming up there, it's still not going to be real good. But there's the picture. And by the way, the arrow's not in the picture. That was imposed later. But can you see it looks like there's this ribbon of light here? And right there is a little spot. You see that? That little spot has become the source of a title of a book. It's called The Pale Blue Dot by Carl Sagan. And here's what he said about it. Because of the reflection of sunlight, Earth seems to be sitting in a beam of light, as if there were some special significance to this small world. You see, that's a picture of Earth from some 4 billion miles away from the Voyager 1 spacecraft. But it's just an accident of geometry and optics. In other words, that beam of light's just an accident. There's nothing special about Earth. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale blue light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all of this vastness, there is no hint that help will come to us from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. Are you sufficiently depressed? That's Carl Sagan's view of life. And I'd have to say, if I believe that life and Earth and the universe was the result of random chance happenings acted on by natural selection, I'd be depressed all the time myself. Because there's no purpose in such things. There's no purpose in your existence, if that's the case. But I can tell you, ever since Darwin in 1859, the common worldview has come to be that both the universe and Earth and all living things are the result of random, unguided processes, and that all there is the natural world, and it produced everything that we see. So do you seriously think, ladies and gentlemen, there's some God out there that cares about that little pale blue dot? And I can tell you, ever since the Copernican Revolution in the Middle Ages, when Copernicus replaced Earth's position, you do know, don't you, that for centuries the common conception was the Earth sat motionless at the middle of the universe and everything else revolved around us, including God's attention. That was the common perception. So when Copernicus and Tycho Brahe and many other astronomers of his day, which, by the way, accomplished incredible feats with no computers, and came up with the notion that no, Earth is not sitting motionless at the center of the universe. In fact, Earth is revolving around the sun, and moon around the Earth. And we're but one of several planets, the heavenly wanderers, that are not at the center of the universe. The common conception that has come out of all that, philosophically and scientifically, is that the Earth is not much special at all. There's nothing special about us. And with Darwinian theory of evolution that came to be so popular over the last 150 to 200 years, surely there's civilizations in lots of other places, probably more advanced than we. And I can tell you, when I was in college, kids, in the early 60s, there was a lot of excitement about finding extraterrestrials. Lots of stories about that. Even a movie came out, do you remember? E.T. And lots of excitement about civilizations. One of my required readings at Harvard University was a book called Intelligent Life in the Universe by Carl Sagan and I.S. Shklovsky, his Russian counterpart. book about this thick in which they spent most of their time claiming this is how we can get in touch with folks out there. Because they were firmly convinced there were civilizations in our Milky Way, probably thousands if not millions of them. And there was much attention given to finding the evidence thereof. Here was one of the equations in that book. It's called the Drake equation after Frank Drake. This was one of the early efforts to try to figure out how many civilizations are there out there in outer space. Well, I don't have time to go through all of this. Can you glance through it with me? Here's the number of communicating civilizations in our galaxy right now. And here are the factors that he thought maybe applied to it. The number of stars, of which there are about 200 billion. Fraction of stars suitable for life. Well, who knows that? It's a pure guess. The fraction of suitable stars with planets. If you watch the news at all, you know they're still looking for stars with planets, don't you? They call them exoplanets, and they get excited every time they find one. And the fraction of the average number of habitable planets or moons per solar system, the fraction on which life develops, who knows that one? Nobody. He comes up now with, what is this number? Somewhere between 0.000005 and 750,000. That's pretty close, wouldn't you say? Well, that's about the best they could do. And of course, they leaned toward the 750,000 at that time. But there was a lot of talk about Drake's equation being the first effort to try to put some mathematics to this. And I will tell you, the common conception was it won't be long till we find one of them, and there are lots and lots of them. Because evolution happens relatively easily. It is beyond belief, ladies and gentlemen, that a whole civilization of people can come to believe in such fairy tales. Evolution is relatively simple. And we have learned in the last 60 years how simple it is. It's more complex than anybody ever dreamed. And I've already said to you once in this series, the origin of life theories are worse off 60 years later than they were when I was in college. Because they thought in those days, we're going to figure this all out. And you remember verse 3 of the song we sang this morning, Our God, He is Alive? Secure is life from mortal mind. God holds the germ within His hand. Though men may search, they cannot find, for God alone does understand, said Brother Dykus, the dean at our college. We had a biology professor in the 1960s who wouldn't sing that verse. Because he said, we're going to figure out how life was formed and be able to do it ourselves. He really believed that. He was a Christian. But he wouldn't sing verse 3. And he said we ought to take it out of the book. Verse 3 is more powerful today than it was 60 years ago. And don't you hesitate to sing it. That brother is dead, by the way. I wish he weren't. So now I want to introduce you to three books. Yeah, the lights can come back on. Thank you. I forgot to tell you that. Because I don't want anybody falling asleep. I don't allow that. The one from which I read to you just a moment ago is The Privileged Planet. I'll get to that in just a minute. But here's an interesting one. Rare Earth. By Peter Ward, Donald Brownlee. Please be assured, class. I'm going to call you my class. Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee are thoroughgoing evolutionists. They absolutely believe life evolved and the universe evolved. But they are now saying, still evolutionists, why complex life is uncommon in the universe. That's what this book is about. That's why it's called Rare Earth. They argue in this book that it is possible there isn't another place in the universe that has complex life like we have here. 50 years ago, these evolutionists would have been laughed out of the room. There are good reasons why they're saying this. Read the book. The second book I want to tell you about is The Privileged Planet by Guillermo Gonzalez and Jay Richards. Guillermo Gonzalez is an astronomer from Iowa State. When this book came out, ladies and gentlemen, he hadn't yet gotten tenure. He'll never get tenure. I will tell you that. Because the university is embarrassed that he would dare to suggest in this book that we might be a privileged planet designed by somebody. But that's precisely what he and Richards suggest. How our place in the universe is designed for discovery, here's the position they make in this book. The very same rare properties that allow for our existence also provide the best overall setting to make discoveries about the world around us. And they said, you can think that's a coincidence, but it sure looks like design to us. And I say, thank you for being open and honest in the face of huge criticism. I recommend this book to you. It's very fascinating. But even more than that, I recommend this because it's written more on your level and mine. The God's Crime Scene by J. Warner Wallace. J. Warner Wallace is a cold case detective raised by atheists. He grew up being a total atheist. He's not anymore. And now he's using the techniques of a cold case detective to examine the evidence for a divinely created universe. He wrote this book in hopes that he could convert his own daddy to believe in God. I love this little book. It's well worth your time. Every chapter is based on a case that he solved. So, I thought what I'd do, let me see what's next here. Yeah. I'm going to read you a little bit. So get comfortable. But don't go to sleep. This is chapter 2. I begin. Helen knew something was wrong when her daughter Carrie failed to answer the door. It was a bright summer afternoon. Carrie said she'd be home, and her car was indeed parked in the driveway. Helen tried to peek through the living room window, but the curtains were unusually drawn. Carrie never locked the back door, but when Helen walked into the backyard of the old home, she found the door locked and all the windows closed. That was not like Carrie. She usually left one badly worn rear window slightly ajar. Helen began to panic. She knew Todd and Carrie had a tumultuous marriage, one that included physical violence. Todd had moved out, but Helen still feared for her daughter's safety. The couple had a child named Lexi, but the violence had only intensified since her birth. A week ago, Todd had threatened to kill Carrie, and just last night, Carrie confided there'd been yet another fight. When Helen couldn't get Carrie to answer the door on this afternoon, she decided to call the police. Our officers responded and met Helen on Carrie's front porch. After getting approval from their sergeant, they forced entry into the home. Approaching the rear of the house, the officers began to smell gas. It was strongest at the base of the stairwell leading to the second floor bedroom. I'm not going to read all of this. They stopped and called the hazmat team to get them out there because of the gas. It took them several hours to get the house even habitable. They ended up getting into the second story and finding two dead bodies, Carrie and Lexi. The question then, ladies and gentlemen, was this a natural phenomenon? Did they die because of accidental causes? Or was there some tampering from without? Well, a cold case detective has to get after the evidence, doesn't he? So he tells a little bit more about the evidence in this case, and I will tell you the end of the story. Todd was convicted of first-degree murder based on the combination of evidence they collected. And here's what J. Warner Wallace would tell you. In any detective case of that type, there are three basic kinds of evidence you look for. Foundational evidence, that's background stuff that impacts it. There's regional evidence, that's stuff in the general vicinity. And then there's locational evidence right in the crime scene. And you look at all of those together and you try to build your case. He said, we're going to do the same thing about, did the universe come about by natural causes, or did somebody tamper with this? So I'll read you this section now. We were compelled to examine the evidence of tampering because of one important fact. There were two dead bodies. In a similar way, when we look at the nature of our universe, the existence of living bodies ought to provide the reason for investigation. See, the question in our case, ladies and gentlemen, is how did the living bodies get here and continue to survive? Like our murder scene, there are foundational, regional, and locational conditions demanding explanation. The foundational laws of physics, the regional properties of our solar system, and the locational conditions of our planet require our explanation. But did this have to be the case? If circumstances had been just slightly different in the case of Carrie's house, Carrie and Lexi would be alive. The conditions had to be just so for the outcome to be death. In a similar way, if circumstances had been just slightly different in our universe, no one would be alive today. Conditions had to be just so for there to be living bodies. Are you with me? So then he proceeds through the book to examine the evidence. And I want to share with you some of those lines of reasoning, which are absolutely fascinating. And I have prayed to God this afternoon to give me the capacity to get this across, because there's a lot to it. And I have 30 minutes. And there it goes again. Thank you. So let's start this way. There's a book called The Goldilocks Enigma, Why is the Universe Just Right for Life? By Paul Davies. Paul Davies is an evolutionist to the core, not a believer in God. But he says, why is the universe just right for life? You remember Goldilocks, don't you? She went out in the forest and found the house of the three bears, remember? She went inside and she found first porridge on the table. She tried the big bowl and it was too hot. She tried the middle-sized bowl and it was too cold. And then she found the baby bear's bowl and it was just right. She ate the whole thing. You remember the story? She kept finding things were too this and too that, and then she'd found the one that was just right. That's why I call this the Goldilocks Enigma. Folks, things have to be just right or you wouldn't be here. One of the most significant facts, arguably the most significant fact about the universe, is that we're part of it. So in this case, ladies and gentlemen, we're trying to solve this mystery because there are living bodies. How did we get here? Why are we still here? Everyone agrees that the universe looks as if it was designed for life. May I say to you, in a court case, if you've got everybody that's involved in the case on the same side, you use that. Well, nobody disagrees with what I'm about to tell you. The universe looks like it's designed to support life. The question is, why is that? Nobody's arguing with that. Everybody agrees. Here's Jay Leslie, another evolutionist, as you can tell from what he says. It looks as if our universe is spectacularly fine-tuned for life. By this I mean only that it looks as if small changes in this universe's basic feature would have made life's evolution impossible. Of course, he believes the way you got here is by evolution, but he knows very well if some small changes were made, you never would have been here. The question is, how do you explain that? The anthropic principle is something evolutionists have made up. Anthropic comes from the word anthropos, which is the word for human beings. The anthropic principle basically says it sure looks like things in nature were made for us. So back in the 1960s, there were two characteristics of the cosmos and 8 to 10 characteristics of the solar system that seemed to be fine-tuned for human life. That's when I was in high school and college. By the 2000s, ladies and gentlemen, we have now discovered 38 characteristics of the cosmos and over 150 of the solar system that seem to be fine-tuned for human life. And my question to you, class, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is how many things do you need to fit together to convict you that somebody tampered with this? And if you were in the court case where Carrie and Lexi got killed, how many circumstantial pieces have to fit together before you're finally convinced that man's guilty of sin? I'll tell you, you reach a point when enough things add up. Let me just throw a few in here. He had threatened to kill her the night before, right? They had a tumultuous relationship. He was a violent man. The whole house was closed up in ways it never was before. The bottom of the stairs had a door that was kind of a sliding door that was never closed, but it was closed that night. The doors upstairs of the bedroom were closed, dirty clothes lying around, and they had a bunch of, or he had, there was a bunch of dirty clothes stuffed under the door. Carrie never left clothes lying around. The vent for the gas stove in her bedroom, which she never used, was open. And the gas had been turned on by somebody. The vent in the hall was closed. And guess who had the gas turned on 2 days before? Todd. All right, how many of those does it take to convince you Todd was messing around and killed his own wife and baby? All right, I ask you, if everybody admits that there's some 188 characteristics of the cosmos and our solar system that all seem to be very finely tuned so we can be here, and if they weren't, we wouldn't be here, how many does it take for you to think somebody designed that? That's my question. So now I'm going to go through 188, okay? No, I'm not. I'm going to pick a few. But be assured, we could talk about 188 of them for the next 6 months. You look for yourself. Don't accept my word for it. Here's some of the foundational factors. Background information about our cosmos.
The strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, the gravitational force, the ratio of electrons to protons, the mass density of the universe, that's only 6 out of 30 some odd characteristics of our cosmos, which are all finely tuned. And if you change them just a little teeny bit, you wouldn't be here. How T90 a bit must you change them?
Okay, I'm going to give you some numbers. The ratio of electrons to protons, both in their numbers and mass, must be precariously balanced. If the value of this ratio, the ratio of electrons to protons here, if that deviated by one part in 10 to the 37th, you wouldn't be here. I'm pausing. The ratio of protons to electrons, you remember what those are? Protons are positively charged particles in the nucleus of atoms. Electrons are the negatively charged particles that are around the outside of the atoms. That ratio is very important for your existence. And if it were changed one part in 10 to the 37th, you wouldn't be here. So he gives an illustration to try to give you some idea of how tiny that variation is, okay? Listen closely. Imagine covering the entire North American continent in dimes and stacking them until they reach the moon. Are you with me? Got this picture? Now imagine stacking just as many dimes again on another 1 billion continents the same size as North America. If you marked one of those dimes and hid it in the billions of piles you've assembled, the odds of a blindfolded friend picking out the correct dime is approximately 1 in 10 to the 37th. The same level of precision required for the ratio of electrons to protons. That give you some feeling? Is that finely tuned? And folks, every one of the ones up there is that finely tuned or worse. Nobody argues with this. If you were my jury, I would say to my prosecuting attorney, or maybe he's the defense attorney over here, I'd say, "Do you agree with that, sir?" And if he didn't, I'd bring out 16 scientific experts and let them tell him, "You're wrong." Because that's exactly the case. Those foundational factors say to us, the cosmos is finely tuned, and if it weren't, we wouldn't be here. There's no argument about that. The question is, how'd that happen? Well, here's what you could say. Isn't it amazing how many coincidences fell together in the cosmos to allow us to exist? All right. There had to be something. I mean, there's life here right now. And I've had it said to me by evolutionists, well, life is here. It had to happen. We're just a lucky planet where it happened to happen. I say, okay, I can take that argument, but for how long does that work? Maybe it works for the 6 I have up here. How about the 38 foundational factors in the cosmos? But now we need to go to the region. The region, you see, is our galaxy. The regional fine-tuned factors support life that have to be just right. So it has to be the proper type of galaxy, ladies and gentlemen. You know, as Carl Sagan would tell you in his series, there are billions and billions of stars and galaxies in the universe. Surely among all those billions and billions, there's going to be lots of civilizations. It's just logical. Well, here's what we know. Just any galaxy won't do. So let's have the lights dimmed again, would you? Everybody awake? Hubble telescope, you know, has taken pictures of things much better from where it flies out of our atmosphere. And there's lots of marvelous pictures. If you haven't gone to the Hubble telescope website and looked at those pictures, you must do it. But here's one. Constellation Serpens, a portion thereof, just one small part of the universe that we can observe through Hubble
Just look at all of that.
And you might say, look at this and that and that and that, and look at all those stars out there. No, ladies and gentlemen. Those large globs, that one and 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 that, those are all galaxies. Those aren't stars. And each of those galaxies has about 200 billion stars in it. So it kind of supports the notion, doesn't it? The possibilities of other civilizations out there in the universe surely is massive. Now you can turn the lights back on. 80% of those galaxies are elliptical. They look kind of like this one. Again, nobody's arguing with these facts. Elliptical galaxies could no more support a system like our solar system. You're not going to be looking at elliptical galaxies for solar systems like our sun has around it, where life exists. They're out of the picture. The magnetic, gravitational, electromagnetic forces that exist inside of elliptical galaxies in no way could support life. So you've just eliminated 80% of all the galaxies in the universe. A bunch of them are irregular, like this one. That's not going to work. And there's lots of reasons for that. The kind of galaxies that support living systems that we know anything about, and there's only one, by the way, are spiral galaxies. And we happen to live in a spiral galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy is a spiral galaxy. But I will tell you, the percentage of galaxies in the universe that we know anything about that are spiral is less than 10%. So that eliminates most of the galaxies in the universe as places where you're going to find life. But it's not good enough to have the right kind of galaxy. We're looking at regional factors. So here's a spiral galaxy looked at from the side. There's a big old bulge in the middle of spiral galaxies, and then there are these spirals out from it. You know, that if you look on from the top, they're like this, but they're out from the side. A solar system that would support life as we know it could not exist anywhere near this. The only two spots in a spiral galaxy are somewhere out here and somewhere out here. Guess where our sun is? Out here. In the spiral galaxy, out on one of those arms. When you take the total volume of a spiral galaxy and you take out all the parts of it where there couldn't be a solar system to support life like we have it, you're down to less than 10% of the total space. So out of the 200 billion stars in our spiral galaxy, you've eliminated 90% of them. Then you've got to have the right kind of star. Not just any star will do. So let me show you. There's our star. Now that's not what it looks like. It looks like a big orange there. But I'm trying to compare the size of our sun to Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune. And here's Earth. And there's Pluto. By the way, Pluto's back as a planet. But our sun looks pretty big there in that one, doesn't it? And it is, it's a huge thing. But compared to some other stars, like Sirius and Pollux and Arcturus, our sun's not that big. And by the way, there's stars a lot bigger than Arcturus. Watch. Here's Arcturus, Rigel, Aldebaran, Betelgeuse, and Antares. Where's the sun? Can you see it right there? You see, our sun is an average-sized star. It's about in the middle of the stars. There's lots of dwarf stars way smaller than our sun. There's lots of stars bigger than our sun, all the way up to Antares. Do you think, class, that a solar system could exist around Antares? Watch me closely. If there were planets around Antares, you know what would happen?
within microseconds, the planets would be sucked into that thing and smashed to smithereens. No, the star has to be just right. And I'm only talking about size. There are 13 other things we should talk about the sun being just right. Got it? Then you have to have the proper mass of the planet. Do you think any just old planet will do? Here are some relative things about our planet. Do you think Jupiter could support life, ladies and gentlemen? If you do, you need to read up. Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, they're all way too big. Pluto, Mars, well, Mars is close. So Earth, Venus, and Mars are close. That's Mercury right there. Here's Earth, here's Venus, and here's Mars. Mercury's too small, Pluto's too small. Now, I wish I could ask you this question, make you answer it. Is anybody looking for life on Venus? It's the closest size to Earth. No, where are they looking for life? On Mars. Why not Venus? Well, even though Venus is close in size, the atmosphere of Venus is hugely sulfuric acid. This is a problem for living things. Plus, there are lots of other problems with Venus. That's why nobody's looking there. Well, there's lots of problems with Mars, too. But they're looking. But can't you see the size of the planet matters? And Earth is just right. Now you could say that's just another one of those many coincidences, ladies and gentlemen, that allowed life to be existing here. Okay, maybe that's another coincidence. But you also have to have the right distance from the sun. There's a zone called the habitable zone. Guess where Earth is? Right smack dab in the middle of the habitable zone. Mars is kind of on the edge. Otherwise, you're not going to have life. It has to have the right spin. Do you know how fortunate it is that our Earth spins at approximately one time every 24 hours? That's a whole subject in itself. But it also has to have the right tilt. Now, you learned this in junior high school, didn't you? What does the tilt do for us? 23.5 degrees. It gives us our seasons, doesn't it? And allows for the distribution of heat. There would be no life on this planet without 23.5 degrees tilt. You need to go home and thank God for 23.5 degrees. No, that's just another one of those coincidences, folks. You have to have the right moon. And it's not just so you can kiss your girlfriend in a romantic way. The moon does all kinds of things for us. There's a whole chapter in this book on the moon. It's very important, the size of the moon, the fact there's only one, the distance that it's from us, all the things that it does for us to support life. Have to have the right atmospheric conditions, the right terrestrial crust, and 140 more. It's like taking the closed door, the clothes stuffed under the door, the gas turned on, and all the other things they found out in that case, and adding another 100 to them, all of which point to murder. And then there's water. If you were in my chemistry class, ladies and gentlemen, you would study water for 6 weeks. It's the most studied substance on the face of the earth. You would think by now we knew everything there was to know about water. We're still learning new things all the time. It's amazing. You can believe if you want to, this is just a coincidence, but you would have no life without water. You know that. What are they looking for on Mars? Water! They're trying to find some teeny bit of evidence there might have been some water up there. And what do we have? It covers 70% of the Earth's surface. 60% of most plants and animals are water. When your sister calls you a waterhead, she is right. Watermelon is 98% water. Man, is that good. Water has a unique structure. Everybody in this class knows water is H2O, right? What you probably don't know is that it's H2O in a very special arrangement. Here's the oxygen, here are the two hydrogens, and the bond angle is 104.5 degrees. That bond angle, ladies and gentlemen, makes all the difference. You would not be here if that bond angle varied within a very small number. I say, thank God for 104.5 degrees. Because it makes water the polar molecule that it is and gives it all the magnificent properties that make it unique. One of the things I would say to you 16 times in my chemistry class is, here's all the other substances we can study, and boom, there's water. Or here are all the properties of other substances, and boom, there's water. It's completely different from most everything. It's an amazing substance. And life absolutely depends on it. It's the only substance on earth that exists in all three states, solid, liquid, and gas. It has a uniquely high specific heat. You want to be between 60 and 90 degrees your entire life, come to St. Petersburg, Florida. It's a peninsula surrounded on three sides of water. You can't change the temperature of water very quickly. You have to put a lot of energy in to raise the temperature, take a lot of energy out to lower the temperature. That's what specific heat's all about. Water has by far the highest specific heat of any common substance. It's like this. Boom! You better be thankful. You're 60% water. That's what regulates your temperature in great measure. Now, you can believe that's a coincidence. When you study water enough, you reach a point where you say, this sure looks like somebody planned this. Has a wide temperature range for liquid, 0 to 100. That's why these planets that are so close to a star can't support life. There's no water. Or it's all gaseous, or it's gone. And if you're too far away, it's all solid, right? Or it doesn't exist. Now, here's one that I just have to spend a minute on. Did you drink? Well, we didn't have ice at lunch today, did we? So the last time you were at a restaurant, did you drink iced tea? Did you happen to notice where the ice was? Wasn't it at the top of your glass? Did you know, class, that solids are supposed to be more dense than liquids? Which means they would sink, right? Solid water is less dense than liquid water. At 4 degrees centigrade, when water begins to solidify, it expands and gets trapped in a lattice. So it's less dense than liquid. So it floats. Did you know you'd be dead if it didn't? There would be no life if water wasn't less dense as a solid. It's one of the unique substances in all of nature. It's the universal solvent. Almost everything dissolves in water. You ever burn your pans, ladies? When I'm stuck with that job, I put water and let it sit for 3 days. It's the best solvent there is. Good thing. Did you know that most of the reactions in your body happen in water solution? Because stuff dissolves in it. It has high surface tension. Have you ever thought about how it is water gets up in a 50-foot tree to the top? You say it rains on it. No, it also sucks it up from the ground. That's because of the properties of water. So, class,
and I'm wearing you out. We didn't touch the hem of the garment. Remember I told you there are at least 188 factors? We may have talked about 15. All of them are finely tuned to allow you to be here. I say, I close my case. You are here because somebody tampered with this universe and made you. You didn't come about by natural causes. There are so many factors involved here. There is no way you can, in your heart of hearts, believe you were not designed by somebody who had your life in mind. I would say to you, class, everywhere we look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things sure look like they're made. And it's overwhelming. Which is why Dr. Michael Behe, in his marvelous book, Darwin's Black Box, said the theme of this series, a loud, clear, piercing cry of design. And I say, amen. So I close by saying, is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age? I will tell you, people are going to stand before God, and he's going to say to them, what did I have to do? What would it take for you? I opened up a floodgate in 1953. You remember the story about the guy that got in the flood? They said, you got to get out of here. He said, I'm staying. So the water got up halfway in his house. He's on the second floor, and they sent him a boat. He said, I'm staying. So he ended up on his roof. They sent him a helicopter. No, I guess it was a second boat first. Now he's on his chimney, and they sent him a helicopter. He said, nope, I'm staying. And of course he drowned. And he's standing before the Apostle Peter, if you'll pardon my joke, saying, why didn't you save me? He said, I sent you two boats and a helicopter. Can I say to you tonight, if you're an atheist, God has sent you 188 factors of this cosmos and this universe that are clearly fine-tuned that you can be here. What does it take? He has shown us how microscopic life works at the microscopic level in a way that we had no concept of 60 years ago. And everywhere you look, there's evidence that I designed that. So what does it take? I say it's more reasonable than ever, and we're going to have to answer for not seeing it. And if you see it, you need to know, go next to John chapter 14. This is our Lord Jesus speaking while he was on earth to his disciples, and he said, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. You see, the next step is you need to know that God loved you enough to send his only begotten Son to help save you and bring you back in a right relationship. If you believe in God, you need also to believe in Jesus Christ. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were so not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. That Jesus who came and gave his life for you is coming back. That's a promise. He's preparing a place just for you and for me. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And where I go, you know, and the way you know. And Thomas said, Lord, we do not know where you're going, and how can we know the way? And he said, he said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me. So I hope that someone who's become convinced that God exists will be determined to find out who Jesus is too. and to become convinced that he came, gave his life for you. And he's waiting to come back again and receive all those who are his to himself. He's the way to God in a way that nobody else is. And we hope you'll find him as well. And our custom at the end of such a service as this in a church building is to offer an opportunity for anybody who wants to say with your mouth, I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God and I want to follow him. And were you to do that based on your own conviction of your heart, with your decision to give your life up and give it to him, then we would stop everything. And I can tell you my testimony is there's water in there. And you can be immersed in water right now for the remission of your sins, because that's what Jesus said to do. And then you can rise to be his disciple the rest of your life. So we're going to sing a song now, and we hope you'll come while we stand and as we sing.